Welcome to Gruesome, your horrific true crime podcast. I am Connie, and my sugar pie honey bun Meg is going to tell us about Andrew Keough.
Yes. You know, when you're around people that are just like really negative, like never happy, pessimistic.
Oh, yeah.
Not my favorite kind of people to be around. The whole time I was writing this episode, that is the vibe that Andrew Keough gave me.
He just
seems like the kind of person who was scared to be happy. Like, it was easier for him to be just like mad at life and then to like accept it as it came and just go with it, you know?
Yeah, I know someone like that. Not like my husband, but I know a husband who is like that, and it's not a good time.
Not my husband, but a husband.
Yeah, not my husband.
Couldn't be.
He's helplessly optimistic, and sometimes I hate that too.
Same. As a hopeless optimistic, I understand that. It's like it's always gonna be good.
Everything's coming up Millhouse.
He sucks. Yeah. Okay. He sucks big time. Little baby trigger warnings, child death, and also some animal death, but not graphically.
Ooh. Okay.
Okay. All right. Andrew Keough was born in Tecumseh, Michigan on February 1st, 1872. Parents. Yeah. It's an old one.
I thought it was going to be like 1974.
Well, it's Andrew, I think, is still a pretty commonly used name. So it could come from any time. He was born to parents Philip and Mary. He came from a farm family. His dad was a successful farmer. He attended Tecumseh High School before moving on to Michigan State University, which at the time was called Michigan State College. While at college, Andrew studied electrical engineering. And when he left, he moved out of Michigan and became an electrician. And he kind of hopped around. At one point, he was in St. Louis, Missouri. But a couple of years later, he moved back to Bath Township, which is a central Michigan suburb outside of East Lansing, which is a sister city to the capital. And as I mentioned, that is where Keough attended college. And that is where he met his wife, Nellie Price, who he married when he moved back to Michigan. The two married in 1919, and then they purchased a plot of farmland from Price's aunt and uncle for $12,000. And that amount today would be like $330,000.
Oh, wow.
So Andrew gave his wife's family $6,000 in cash, and he took out a $6,000 mortgage for the rest. And he got like 100+ acres of farmland with that money. Could you imagine buying 100+ acres for $12,000?
No.
No. It's madness.
I didn't even get a quarter acre for that much money.
Right? Ooh. Now, Andrew loved to tinker and build. He went to school for engineering, so he was very like mechanically inclined, but he was kind of a shit farmer. I get the impression that he wasn't patient, but he was pretty good at working on tractors and tinkering with the tools and really optimizing his workshop to allow him to like increase his farm's yield. But despite his ability to have well-running equipment and everything he needed, he was unable to make his farm profitable. And this made him incredibly bitter about it. It felt like he was mad because he had paid all this money for this land so that he could farm it, but he wasn't making any money off of it. And at the time, wholesale prices for crops were dropping rapidly, and Keough was not outdoorsy. So farming was not a good move for him in the first place. He hated feeling unclean. By his neighbors' accounts, as soon as he would get dirty, he would drop what he was doing, go home, clean up and change his clothes, and then come back to work.
That is not what farmers do.
It is not very farmerly. No, I thought that too. I was like, I don't think there's a legit farmer alive who is going to go change his clothes because he's dirty. To that, he was not good with animals either.
Oh,
he at one point had shot a neighbor's dog because it barked too much. He fed a cow until it developed a bloated stomach and died. And at one point, he beat his own workhorse to death for plowing too slowly. Like, this was not a nice man.
Oh, he's the worst man.
Yeah, he is just... And despite failing at running his farm, he did succeed in one area of his life. He was very good at campaigning to get what he wanted. It was kind of, if it suited him, he would work very hard to get it there. So in 1922, 3 years after he was married and after he had settled into his land, Bath Township decided that they were going to replace all of the one-room schoolhouses with a single larger school. And the community was very excited about the prospect of being able to bus students to the central location where classrooms are going to be sorted by grade. It would allow them to all have better facilities and these kids would get a better education. It was just going to be good for the community. And Andrew Keough hated it.
Of course he did.
He was infuriated by the prospect of this school because a new school meant constructing a municipal building. And to Keough, a new municipal building meant an increase in his taxes. And everyone in the area saw a property tax hike in 1922, 1923, 1924. Also, we're like moving up to the Depression at this time too. So it's getting rocky for everyone. And people were annoyed that they had to pay more money. But Keough felt like this increased tax rate was like a personal slight against him.
Yeah, and they were like, hey, you man, the shitty farmer.
Yeah, you suck at farming, so how about you pay us some more money? Yeah, no, he was infuriated by it. He and Nellie had both been raised Roman Catholic, and they were both devout churchgoers. But their parish decided to build a new church. And when this happened, the priest was like, hey, we're going to ask each family to tithe a certain amount of money. And the church asked Keough to tithe $400 to aid in its construction. And after the priest asked that, Keough didn't attend another church service ever again.
That's the only part of it I'd kind of be like, okay.
Yeah, sense. I understand. I have weird feelings about tithing anyways. I think it's to each their own, but...
Shouldn't be mandatory.
So he never went to church again, and he refused to let his wife attend as well, which it's the 20s. Yeah, she should have been able to just go, but times were different. Just like it was the 50s in the last episode.
Yep.
Keough believed that he owed nothing to the community, to the world. You know, I feel like we all kind of work together. Like socially to create a better world. And he was like, not me. It's me against this world. And he was just full of this self-righteous anger. And he was so pious. He threw himself into fighting against these increased property taxes and the people who were trying to get him to pay money. And it got him nominated and elected to the school board because his platform was restricting spending. And people were with that. They were like, yeah, we don't want to spend money on stuff that we don't need to spend money on. You seem very hyped about that. So we're going to elect you to this position. But his goal was to eliminate all spending, which is impossible.
No.
He ended up being so intense about it that he became the school board's treasurer. And he was actively working against the school from the inside. Anything that needed to be done, if it involved spending money, he voted against it. He attempted to squash even the most basic, like, expenditures. He didn't want to pay the bus drivers. Like, he did not want them to spend money whatsoever. The school superintendent was a guy named, it just gave a, because it's so old, it just gave an initial. So it's E. Hike. And he felt like this guy was useless. Like he wasn't doing anything for the school. He wasn't helping. And he had been voted in because people appreciated his ability to pull back on unnecessary expenses. But he became such a pain in the ass and so combative all the time that people would just give him what he wanted because he refused to compromise and they didn't want to deal with him. He was so obnoxious about it that he would immediately adjourn any board meeting he felt like wasn't going his way. He's like, if I'm not going to get what I want, I'm going to leave. Yeah, like a baby. He felt like he was doing such a good job on the school board and everyone liked him so much that he ran for town clerk in 1926. And he was the only one surprised when he was defeated and did not win the position. And this defeat caused a shift to happen within Keo. In 1926, Keo's neighbor, Monty Ellsworth, reported that Keo's farm had stopped growing anything. When it came time to harvest, there was nothing for Keo to do. Keo had given a guy a horse. He was like, here's this horse. You can borrow it. And the guy returned it thinking that Keo was trying to get rid of his stuff because he wanted to commit suicide. Like, because he was just like giving away horses, giving away equipment, like just getting rid of everything. And honestly, he wasn't far off. He might have just left Bath Township completely if it wasn't for one thing. That summer, the new school had been infested by a swarm of bees. Hike, the superintendent that he hated, was tasked with removing that infestation of bees, and he failed. He didn't do it. And Andrew just reveled in that. And so he took it upon himself to remove the bees to just show the superintendent, like, hey, I think you're an idiot and I can do the thing that you failed at.
Yeah, look how much better than you I am.
Mm-hmm. And he did succeed. He got the bees out and everyone was very thankful. And afterward, Andrew volunteered to become the school's general caretaker and custodian. And his offer was accepted. Nobody thought it was strange that he began spending so much time at the school the following year. No one considered that he might be planning something that would drive him into the foundation of the school and the basement of the building that had come to symbolize everything that he had grown to hate. Nobody realized that something like failing to win a small town election could cause this man to snap. And there was a lot that people didn't know about Andrew Keough. They knew he was really good with electrical systems, that he could wire something up, no problem. But they did not know how much he knew about explosives. In the years before 1927, Keough had been experimenting with explosives in many ways. Positive and fruitful ways for his neighbors. He would blow up tree stumps and rocks for himself and for other farmers who needed them removed in order to plow the fields. He ran the New Year's Eve fireworks show that would wow the town every year. He bought hundreds of pounds of explosives on trips into Lansing, and he would take them back to Bath himself. And he would store them at his farm so that if anyone needed any, they could just visit him rather than having to go all the way to the city themselves. Andrew came from a large family. He was among the youngest of 13 children.
Oof.
He was often unsupervised, rarely regarded, and when he was still young, somewhere between 5 and 8 years old, I couldn't get a straight answer, his mom died. Andrew's father remarried, and Andrew and his stepmother did not get along. They would fight bitterly, and as the years would go on, their relationship would only get worse. At 14, Keo's stepmother made him stay home and watch the kids younger than him, because she had to leave for the day to get errands or to do errands and to get groceries. And so he was left there kind of unsupervised and just left to his own devices with these younger kids. When she returned, while she was putting away her purchases, she started to cook dinner for the family, and the kitchen's oil-burning stove exploded, immediately covering her in flames. As she burned, Andrew watched.
Ugh.
Eventually, he threw water on her, which he knew would exacerbate the grease fire that was covering her, and his stepmother died of the injuries that she sustained during that explosion. The stove, it was revealed, had been tampered with.
So May, he did it.
Yeah, he definitely killed his stepmom with an exploding stove. He left home shortly after that, though. Like, he didn't stay at the house for much longer following her death. May of 1927 brought a beautiful spring to Michigan. The leaves were showing on the trees, and students were preparing to finish the school year, return home for the summer planting season. No one, again, thought it was odd how much Andrew Keough seemed to have calmed down. He wasn't trying to fight everyone anymore. He wasn't trying to stop spending. At a board meeting, he uncharacteristically voted to approve all the expenditure bills presented. Anything they were like, we want this, we want this. He was like, okay, all right, you can have it. You can have whatever you want. A kindergarten teacher asked Keough if she would be able to use some of his woodlands for a school picnic, and he agreed, but suggested that she move the date forward, saying, if you're going to have a picnic, you best have it right away. He joked with one of the bus drivers named Warden Keys that the bus driver accidentally dropped his paycheck in the mud when he was taking it from Keough because he was the treasurer. And he said, you want to take good care of that check. It's probably the last one you'll ever get. Ominous.
Yeah.
On Sunday, May 15th, he rested. And then for the next 2 days, Andrew Keough went to work. First, he went to every tree on his property and he stripped the bark off in a circular ring around the base, which kills trees. Then he murdered his wife. He placed her body behind his barn and then meticulously hand-carved a wooden sign and strung it to the barbed wire fence at the edge of his property. Then he went to bed, woke up, had a nice breakfast, and blew up his farm.
Jesus!
On May 18th, his property burst into flames. His neighbors witnessed several explosions and ran over to help. But as they made their way there, they found Keough going in the opposite direction and he waved them off. He yelled at them to go down to the school. The Bath Consolidated School building had been partially bombed. The North Wing, which housed its youngest students, 7 to 12, had been completely destroyed, exploded with 500 pounds of military surplus pyrrhotol.
Jesus!
The South Wing was undamaged, but it too had been wired with explosives. Keough was furious. The wiring, he might have laid it incorrectly. He thought maybe it short-circuited. Something had been knocked loose from the force of the North Wing's blow. But regardless, the entire town was in chaos. Nearly 40 people were dead. 38 children and 2 teachers were killed in the explosion
that happened in
the north wing of the building. Red Cross workers were working tirelessly. There was a local pharmacy that had to become a stand-in trauma ward. Firefighters and farmers pitched in to help. Keough did not join in. He stood by his vehicle and watched the school burn. As he was standing there, the school superintendent, Yi Haik, showed up. He had hoped that he would have killed him in the blast, but he had brought his rifle just in case. He called Haik over to his car, and when Haik approached, Keough took out his weapon, aimed it at the trunk of his vehicle, because in his trunk he had stashed another 100 pounds of explosives, and he fired off his final round. The car exploded, killing both Andrew Keough and Superintendent Hike.
Holy shit.
Yeah. He just blew up everything. For years in the community afterward, there were people who had been disfigured by the explosions. And by post-mortem estimates, Andrew Keough had a the thing that's frustrating about this is, like, he was mad that he owed money to people. He was mad he had to keep paying this mortgage even though he didn't farm. He was mad that he didn't get what he wanted within the town. But he could have sold off all of his tools and tractors and all the stuff he was into and paid off his loan and then had money left over. And he would have owned his land outright. But he didn't want to because they were like his toys. And if he couldn't have something, then he didn't want anyone else to have it either.
Yeah.
So when investigators came to search his house, they found more than just Keough's wife's remains in the wreckage of the barn. They found all of the animals that were on his farm. He had locked them in to ensure that they would also die in the explosions. His wife's family, the people who had sold him that land, re-inherited the farm once Andrew and Nellie had passed. And Keough wanted to make sure that they got as little as possible when they re-inherited it.
Like, just out of spite? Like,
yes, yeah, just to spite them. Like, he felt like it should have just been given to him.
Ugh.
Like he shouldn't have had to have paid for it.
He got 100 fucking acres, man.
Yeah. His neighbors knew that he had stopped growing crops, but they didn't know that he had also stopped paying his mortgage tax, too, and he had stopped paying all of his insurance. So after rubble was cleared, damages were paid, his in-laws had nothing, and the town was not the same again for years and years after these crimes were committed. One of the great nephews of one of the victims said he remembers one of his older family members telling him that Michigander children, not even alive at the time of the blast, would say their prayers at night, and they would say, "Love to everybody in the world except Keough."
Which, yeah, they're same.
Same. And there's a bunch of memorials commemorating the victims of the Bath School bombing. That is one of the worst school killings in America ever. And there was the sign that he had strapped to the front that he had hand carved after he murdered his wife that said, "Criminals are made, not born."
I feel like that's a popular saying now.
Yeah, I don't know if...
Like, I've heard that several times.
I don't know where it originates from. Criminals are... Let's look it up.
Yeah, so say let's...
Let's take a little goog here. It doesn't really quote origin. The quote is by Cesar Lombroso. "Man is not born a criminal, but becomes one due to abnormal traits."
I also heard that it's from William Randolph Hearst.
So lots of Italian criminologists. This guy's, I don't know. But he planned that whole bombing for his house and the school and everything for more than a year.
Which explains why he was like, "Oh yeah, guys, spend what you want. This
whatever, do whatever you want, because it's all going to be gone soon." Which we see a lot, I think, in serial killings, and just when people are ready to commit, like, the murder they've been thinking about for a long time, they just suddenly become passive about everything.
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Whatever you need. Whatever you want to do. Yeah. It's, I had never heard of it.
About that.
But it was alarming, and I thought you would think it was interesting.
I do. I love an old-timey case, not the crime, and I hate when it's against children as well. But what if I think what sucks is we all collectively, everyone who's listening, can think of a person in their life where they've come across that fits that description.
That's like that. Yes, absolutely. And you're just like,
just, oh, woe is me, everything happens because of, like, to me.
Everything happens to me, and it's everyone else's fault but mine.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And
that's terrifying.
It is. I was reading about it, and they were talking about, like, potential motives, and there was one that was, like, suicide ideation. And then they were like, could have been financial difficulties. And then one of them said, and it was an injustice collector personality. And I had never heard what that was. So I like looked it up. I was like, what's an injustice collector personality? And it's that they believe that they can never get enough, but they deserve to get unending attention and admiration and just like blind obedience to whatever they want.
Yeah, I there were a few unsubs on Criminal Minds that that's what they had. They were injustice collectors.
Yeah, I had never heard that. I was just like, and that's what they thought maybe he was. They also thought maybe he had an antisocial personality disorder, which isn't, again, it's also common.
I think he just wanted to make them suffer as much as he internally felt like he was suffering. Because now, not only those 38 children that died, their parents are dealing with that. They have to handle that. And like you said, this is Great Depression era. So all the money that they had spent on taxes for this school, they're just going to have to do that and then some.
Yeah. Well, technically the Great Depression didn't start to like 1929, but and this was in like 1927. So it was like 2 years before, like, but it was kind of
through it. But you know how long it takes to build a school.
Yeah, there was, I think it, and also the fact that like his wife was chronically ill with tuberculosis and she was in the hospital for like extended periods of time, and she came home from the hospital and he murdered her.
Ugh. What a fucking awful person.
Yeah, he's gross. They're always gross, but the explosions within the school were timed. He had like a detonator, and so he
this
had,
is pretty like intense for 1927.
Yeah, well, I mean, he had studied electrical engineering. He was very good with like wiring. He had been doing explosions for a long time. Like he was doing them for his neighbors. He was doing them for himself. He was experimenting them when he was younger. Yeah, we don't know what he was doing when he was left from Michigan and then came back. There's no record of what he was doing during that time.
Just think about how beneficial his skills could have been had he used them for good instead of being evil.
Well, he didn't know how, you know. He didn't know how to be I don't know. It feels like negative people who constantly feel like indignant and wronged and like everything is against them. It's like their like subconscious is fixed on it. You know, there's no way to like snap them out of it. All you can do is like do your best and hopefully they catch on.
Yeah. That just sucks.
Yeah. I think that if you're around people who like that, just like take responsibility for your own happiness and don't let them mess you up.
Well, that's like the behavior versus personality type thing. And I've had the conversation before where it's like that is their personality. It is their personality to be constantly net. You can't change. You can't change personalities. Like behaviors are one thing. You can do therapy. You can, you know, there are ways to therapies and like things you can do to change your behavior.
Coping mechanisms.
That's right. I was trying to think of the word. But that is who you are. And some people are just so pessimistic. It is so ingrained. You could be like, here's $1 million. And they're going to be like, I have to pay taxes on this.
They're like, oh, great. Like they find the negative thing. Or they're
great.
Like,
now I have to deal with this. I have to deal with this. Or
like, you look so good today. Oh, I didn't look good yesterday.
Yeah.
Yes. It's just like, and you, like, when you interact with people like that, you have to be, you constantly have to be the more mature person, and like be, like, it makes you constantly have to think like, okay, how do they actually mean this? Maybe mm-hmm. it's not, it's just like, they don't even
I can't be around people
that they're
like
doing
that.
It. Yeah.
It's, like, I can't. It's hard when nothing, I am all about accountability. I think it's because, and I would say you too, like, we are both pretty, we hold ourselves pretty accountable. And I,
yeah, can't, the phrase like, no one's harder on you than you're on, like, you are on your,
that's
than
us.
On yourself. Yeah, that's us for that's sure. Us. We're like, no one's gonna talk more shit to me than me. I promise you. I'll be in
but
my head about it.
The people who have problems with jobs and they have problems with everybody they interact with, it's like, well, I have this supervisor and I hate that supervisor and they just don't like me. I don't know what I did.
If they weren't there, it wouldn't be so bad. I'm like,
it's
that's
that
a, I promise.
Mentality. It's, like, it's.
Yeah.
Bro, like, it's
what's
you.
The common denominator here?
Yeah, it's you move jobs you. And you're still having the same problem. Like, what is that? Who is that? That's you.
Mm-hmm.
Or even, like, you know, women, you know, I guess men can do it too, but you see a lot with women who they always have problems with their friends. And it's yeah. like, what is? What are we seeing here? What is the denominator?
Yeah, just, it's, I don't know. Kill them with kindness, friends, if you're out there. I feel like that's all you can do, right?
Well, yeah, because there's no.
There's no fight. Like, you can't
you
fight them.
You just know, you can't go, like, it's hard when you go into that conversation knowing they're just going to bitch the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Never their fault, though. Never.
It never has been. It never will be.
No. And how dare you even. How dare you even.
How dare you.
How dare you even insinuate.
There was this one.
There
was this one time I lived in this apartment building in Indianapolis. And there was a couple down the hallway who would fight. And I loved it. Oh, man. It made me, like, I didn't, it's a bummer that they were fighting, but I loved listening because it was always so dramatic. And yeah. One time I was, like, kind of lingering outside my door so I could listen. And I just heard the door, their door slam, and she went, how dare you? And I was like, I've never heard it in real life. I've never heard someone do
how
it in real life.
How dare you?
How dare, and, like, she was, like, aghast. And I had never been happier than I was in that moment hearing
you know,
her say that. It was like
always,
a real life soap opera.
I always say, I'm not a fan of drama like my own. Other people's drama, big fan.
Yeah, big fan of being in. Do not want to be the person that it is happening to. But I would love to hear about it.
When we talk about, like, drama with people, we're not even remotely associated with.
We're like, oh my God, did you see that? Yes, that's why I think that's why I like pop culture so much, though.
Oh, and just, yeah.
Because oh, it's just yeah. like, obviously, it's not just us. It's
everyone.
Trillions of
that's
people.
Why there's so many reality shows. Like,
mm-hmm. It's just like you like to be in the know, but also have no bearing on your life whatsoever.
I started
a lot easier
watching
that way.
I watched ever since like Scandoval with Vanderpump Rules. I watched, like, that season, and then I've been watching, like, the new season. But I got to the point where I was like, I gotta know the history of why these people all hate each other. So I started from the beginning, and I was like, oh, the audacity of all of you. And
you guys are all in the wrong.
My husband walked in, and he was like, I don't know how you watch this shit. Because he's someone, he doesn't even like to hear about the drama. Like, I can tell him tea about two people down the street that I just heard about in passing at the grocery store, and he doesn't even care. Doesn't care one bit. Just a big old waste of my time.
Like, it's fine that you don't care. I just want you to learn about it so you can tell me.
Yeah, I want you to know what kind of the buzzwords of what I'm looking for when you're out in the wild so you can tell me as well.
That's what I need in a relationship. I need you to know that I am constantly on the lookout for OPD, other people's drama.
That's, you know, OPD. Yeah, you know me. That should be a sticker. I just love it. I love all. That's honestly probably why we are so fascinated by true crime.
It is. Yeah. It's just the idea of. being in the know, I guess, or like being able to dive deeper and find out why things happened and when they happened. And that's part of what I like about researching things is I'll be reading through something and I'll see they say something. I'm like, what did that mean? And I have to go look at that. Like when you said like criminals are made, not born. That's a thing. Let's Google that. Where did that come from? It's like researcher brain.
Oh, and I will see two people fighting on Facebook. I don't even know who the fuck they are. Like, it could be on a random group that pops up on my feed, and I'm like, oh, ooh, let me see what's going on in your life.
I know. That's why I always read the comments on, like, posts. I'm like, what is this comment saying? What are they talking about now?
Every single post on our community page, I am like there with popcorn. Like, all right, Terry, what do we got to say this time?
On your community page? Like for your neighborhood?
Yeah, because people get so bit out of shape. So bit out of shape.
I have a new community page that I've been following because I moved.
Is there tea?
There's not really anything. No. This lady lost her cat.
I always see that. Looking for my dog.
Yeah, this lady lost her cat. She found it under the house. She's trying to lure it out. She asked if anybody had a live trap. What else? There's a kid who wants to find someone who works in construction so he can look around. There's a lady that's cleaning houses. It's like, it's nothing exciting.
Wait till election season.
Summer. I did work in the local dentist office this week, mm-hmm. and it was 500 feet away from my house. One, that was very cool to walk to work. Two, I got a wealth of information about all the things.
Like, were they like, oh my gosh, you're the one who bought the church house?
Yes. Yes, they were. But also, they were very willing to give up any and all information. And that's one of my favorite parts about being a dental hygienist is, like, I can ask you questions and you feel obligated to answer because you have nowhere to go. You're trapped with me. And I'll just keep asking questions. I can do open-ended questions all day long.
I hate when, when my mouth is open, like, getting cleaned and they're like asking you questions, I'm like,
yeah. Sometimes we forget. Well, I forget. Like, I'll be talking to someone and I'll ask them a question and I realize I'm still, so I have to take my instruments out and be like, go ahead, tell me your answer. And then,
because I want to know what's up with Sheila down the street.
Yeah, exactly. And once they tell me, I put it back in and I do my half of the conversation or my part of the conversation. And then I ask them another question. I take my instruments out and let me tell me.
And I think that's why I love brunch so much.
Because it's where you get all the information.
I had someone here that was like, let me draw you a picture of this family dynamic. And I was like, please do.
There's Please visual? Show me the triangulation. I would There's love to know visual? What's happening.
I feel like it's like that when I think or talk to people back home and they're like, well, you know, such and such. They're with this person and then this happened, but they have kids with this person and now they're fighting with this person. And I'm like, ooh, the tea is piping. Piping.
Man, I never get those. I never get the back home talks.
Dude, my sister still tells me, and I'm like, I care deeply about all of this. So please tell me.
I want to be informed. My brother that still lives in our hometown does not care. So
he's the worst gossip. He always has been.
He has no information to give me. Sometimes he does, but it's never like... it's never bad or like that dramatic. How his wife, however, made up for it. Yeah.
All the tea.
She's got it. She's got it unlocked. And I'm like, nice. Tell me things.
I had previously told my husband how we've talked about on here before, how we have like, we still lie all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh yeah, we were so good at it. It was weird. And he had never.
No way were we good at it.
I think we were. He witnessed it in real time because my dog, Stark, is a very anxious little nugget. And every time I put him in the car, he literally has panic attacks. So I have not, I'll like give him mom haircuts, but I haven't groomed him like he should be. And I know, bad dog, but he's like, he just had his 11th birthday. He's old as dirt. I just want him to live happy and peaceful for the rest of his days.
And I don't want to stress him out by getting haircuts. I understand. Yeah,
because he like vomits. He gets so stressed out. I have to like give him freaking Xanax to even take him anywhere. And his brother is, his brother's belongs to my husband's aunt. And we were all sitting there. My mother-in-law was talking to me about our dog. And she was talking about how we needed to get him groomed. And I made up this whole thing about, I was like, oh yeah, he uses a mobile groomer, but she's been in Florida. Instead of being like, he's fine.
Instead of being like, I'm an adult, I'll deal with my dog myself.
It's like, I'm barely groomed. Like, come on, man.
Dude, I can't do it anymore. I can't build a house of cards like that. I'm always waiting for it to fall if I do.
And he just looks at me and we leave and he was like, that was both impressive and terrifying. And I'm like, you know, once I start going, it just starts rolling. Can't stop. Can't stop, won't stop. Hashtag.
They just are asking. They're like, okay, that's enough. We don't need any more details on this. The more details there are, the more I am assuming you're lying.
Yep. I need very basic. Very basic.
Oh, man.
But sometimes I do give details if I'm trying to explain myself because I feel like people don't believe me because I have lied so many times.
That's like a mental illness you've inflicted upon yourself. I know. Maybe you did that to yourself.
Baby, it's your fault. You're not 17 trying to sneak out of the house anymore. Just tell your mom where the fuck you're going.
I understand that, though. Like the feeling that you're going to get in trouble.
Always.
Like, if I can't do it, they're going to be mad at me. And then the other part of me comes in, and I was like, who gives a fuck if they're mad at me? I'm an adult. They can be mad all they want.
I'm a whole adult.
They probably don't care. I'm assuming they probably don't care.
Don't read our comment section, because they do, man. They do.
They care.
They care.
It's good. We're glad that you care. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to end. Yeah, we're glad you care.
We're glad you care. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Gruesome, Horrific, True Crime.
We love you, beautiful strangers. And if you love us, too, here are some ways that you can support Gruesome. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or a 5-star rating on Spotify. This helps other true crime connoisseurs find us. Follow us at Gruesome Podcast on Instagram or TikTok and talk to us on our posts.
Join the Patreon. Sign up to join our True Crime Sticker of the Month Club and gain access to bonus episodes and exclusive Patreon perks. Or if a one-time donation is more your thing, we have a Venmo at Gruesome Podcast and a PayPal via our email, gruesomepodcast@gmail.com.
Speaking of which, we love hearing from you. It seriously makes our whole life. So send us your questions, comments, suggestions, or just ask our opinion on whether that person you met on Tinder is a serial killer or not.
Tune in next week, and don't forget, lock your windows, lock your doors, and on Wednesdays,
we're gruesome.
Bye.
Bye.